I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. And of course, we come your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. From Co-op Radio. KOOP is a cooperatively run community radio station, all volunteer community radio station in Austin, Texas, but we are also rebroadcast by a couple of other community radio stations in other parts of the country, and our podcast goes all over the place. If you want to stream the show, or if you want to look at our podcasts or whatever, go to the Rag Radio, go to the ragblog.com/ragradio. And for future streaming, it's koop.org. And if you want to get in touch with us, it's ragradio@koop.org. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. He's laughing.
Yeah, it's like happy to be here. Thank you so much.
We're always happy to have you, Tracy.
Oh, thank you.
Roger
thank
Baker's you. Taking pictures, and who knows, Roger might slip in and ask a question. Since Roger's actually an expert on fossil fuel indulgence and fracking and transportation and economics and whatever. He's not just a picture taker. Robert Jensen is in the studio with us. And my guest, since we drive in the left lane on Rag Radio, what we're approaching the intersection of literature and fracking. Which and we will slow down now for that intersection. So my guest is Taylor Brorby.
Great to be here, Thorne.
We're thrilled to have you.
Thank you.
This is going to be so much fun. Who's just in town for a day or two. So Taylor Brorby is an award-winning essayist and a poet. His work has appeared in High Country News, Canary, Written River, the Northern Plains Ethics Journal, among others. Taylor speaks regularly around the country about issues relating to fracking and the Bakken oil boom, and is a fellow at the Black Earth Institute. His chapbook of poems, Ruin, Elegies from the Bakken, is through Redbird Chapbooks, and he is the editor of the anthology Fracture, his new work, Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America from Ice Cube Press. He is currently at work on a collection of poetry as well as a collection of essays. And this is a fascinating book. In fact, our friend Bob Jensen has a piece in it.
Has a wonderful essay in it.
Wonderful essay. And so we're going to talk about all of this, how you came to doing all of this. It's fascinating. Talk about the book. Talk about some of the things that are in the book. But I can't go any longer without asking you this.
Yeah.
Tell me about your father's infield grand slam.
Oh, my goodness. You have read the essay. Well, there's this little town in southwestern North Dakota, Thorne, called Belfield, and it's semi-desert climate down there, and there would be this thing that I mention in the essay called the ritual. And
right.
When we would approach the baseball field driving down to Wyoming, he would go, Taylor, and then he would launch into the highlight of what I assumed was his young life of the bases were loaded, and Jim Brorby walked up to the plate and hit an infield grand slam and won the game. That was the ritual, both when we would drive down to Wyoming and drive back.
So we don't really know more details about how he managed to turn an infield grounder into a...
Exactly.
We can imagine. That's up for our imagination. This is radio. You visualize.
That's right.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your background, how you got to this point, and how it is that you kind of came to this intersection.
Sure. So I'm originally from western North Dakota. I grew up with the Badlands as my backbone, and the Missouri River was the main artery. I grew up 15 miles from where Lewis and Clark spent more time on their journey than any other point, Fort Mandan. My entire upbringing, actually generationally, was supported by lignite coal. Both of my parents work in coal, and somehow they got an environmentalist out of the deal, I guess. But the Bakken oil boom came to town 2006, 2007, when I was away at undergraduate, and just started exploding. Towns, you know, less than a decade would quadruple in size. Towns that I grew up knowing to be 14,000 would go to 40,000, which, you know, to people in Austin, a 40,000-person town probably doesn't seem that big. But it means, what does the infrastructure look like? How do you adapt with social workers, with teachers, with nurses? And so I started following more of the newspapers highlighting this topic. And when I was actually living in a remote village, actually in the North Cascade Mountains, just north of Wenatchee, Washington, the North Dakota Humanities Council had contacted me and a fellow North Dakota writer, Deb Marquardt, to go and teach creative writing for a month, about 3 weeks, in 13 communities impacted by the oil boom. And this was in 2013. It was the first time Deb and I had ever been in the oil boom. And the only way I can really describe it, I mean, you can see North Dakota from space at night, and it gives off more light pollution than Minneapolis-St. Paul. But it looks like that scary lake of fire in the Book of Revelation. You know, as the sun sets, you start seeing the horizon dance. And that's sort of been a nerving feeling, and I haven't quite been able to get over it. So I've been spending my summers living and writing in Western North Dakota.
I have to tell you that I found your testimony on behalf of the Sierra Club before the Iowa Utilities Board. And it's because, and you describe a lot in detail, and it's fascinating as a way to learn about this. Let's go to the testimony. Let's go to the official documents.
Well, and I currently live in Iowa, is something listeners should know too, Thorne. So that's why I appeared before the Iowa Utilities Board. Right now we're facing a massive pipeline. What many people are arguing is Keystone 2. It would come from the Bakken oil boom, cut across South Dakota, right diagonally through Iowa to Patoka, Illinois, and then shoot straight south to the Gulf. And a Canadian oil company earlier this year in February had just applied for a permit for a $600 million pipeline to connect the Bakken into Canada, which of course seems like a low-stake pipeline when it's just a short one. But once it crosses that international border, it's easy to just reverse the flow of different pipelines to start accessing potentially the Canadian tar sands as well. Right. So that's where that testimony comes from. 25 million gallons a day would be flowing across Iowa soil. And we still don't know the outcome of it just yet.
Right, right. Okay, so why this book? Why the idea of bringing together basically literature, poetry, essays, about not just fracking, but about the environment, as a way to, I assume, do two things. One, it's an expression. It's a literary expression. I mean, it's a fascinating book. There's a lot of really, really strong material in it, but it's also obviously a statement of environmental activism.
Yeah, this is one of those ideas that it's sort of like a rock fell on your head. And I was at a release party for another book, and the publisher of Ice Cube Press, Steve Semkin, was there. And we had not met, and we were just chatting, and he asked where I had just moved from. I'd moved to Ames to go to graduate school at Iowa State. And I'd said, well, I just moved from Western North Dakota, and we bonded over that, about the Badlands, and bonded over a great Minnesota writer, Paul Grucco, that we both loved. And I just said out of the blue, I'm so surprised no one has done an anthology on fracking. And he said, well, that's a good idea. And I made a little mental note and went home and drew up a query letter, and then he asked for a full book proposal. And a week later, we were embarking on this project. But Thorne, I have to say, it's kind of a selfish project, too, because a lot of the media landscape, we know who Josh Fox is, and we know who Sandra Steingraber is as well. But that sort of focused more out east. You know, you don't hear a lot so much about Oklahoma or Texas or North Dakota. We know there's oil booms happening here, but we're not having these big cultural activists rise up. So I thought, wouldn't it be great to have an anthology that actually seeks to connect these dots, not only where fracking's happening, but where the byproducts of fracking are felt, like, you know, a year ago in January when the train derailed in West Virginia and exploded and the river was on fire. It's sort of my attempt with, you know, in a choir of writers to say it's not just in North Dakota, Texas, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, you know, some interior West states. it's really far more insidious than we think.
You know, I have to, as a side line here, we really need to fight global warming fast because we need to protect Ice Cube Press.
That's true. Exactly. they might be melting.
We might be facing a meltdown.
Exactly.
Okay. Tell me, before we actually go in, because I really want to talk about some of the material in the book.
Yeah, certainly.
Tell me what you think. Give me your opinion of fracking and what it's doing. And give me an overview.
Yeah.
Which, of course, also fits into our whole situation with fossil fuel. And as Roger would point out, I mean, the fracking boom is now pretty much over.
Yeah.
and it's become too expensive to frack now.
Well, and we're starting to see things slow down, which means we have more attention to see what we've been missing. And I think that's sort of what I hope this anthology complements. Different from, you know, things we see on the news that sort of pass by quickly. Literature, I hope, makes us pay attention better. And so what are some of the things we're seeing right now because of fracking? Well, we're seeing the longest river on the continent, the Missouri River, is now compromised, certainly. We're seeing towns like Glendive, Montana, a little town last year, when an oil pipeline ruptured underneath it, the residents of the town couldn't drink their water for well over a week because the Bakken oil is some of the most volatile oil on the planet and has known cancer-causing agents in it. Fish as far downstream in the Yellowstone, over 100 miles downstream, had oil in their muscle tissue well over a month later. Well, that spill emptied right into the Missouri River. We know now fracking, because you know, we need science to confirm things we know, causes earthquakes, at least in Oklahoma, you know, as shifting plate tectonics, which is quite frightening. We know flares in the Bakken continue global warming in a rapid scale and emit carcinogens into the air. We also know fracking means we have to admit we don't really care about a lot of people. Where's fracking happening? Well, fracking's happening around Native American reservations, and the amount of natural gas flared is typically higher on American Indian reservations throughout the country. We also know fracking means communities that aren't prepared to handle this experience derailing trains. You know, Castleton, North Dakota, 30 miles outside of Fargo. They got a great New Year's present the other year. A train derailed a mile of town. And I kept thinking, well, what would happen if that train would have derailed in downtown Fargo? It'd be like in Loch McEntee up in Canada, where in July of 2013, an oil train derailed, carrying Bakken oil, and spilled several thousand barrels of oil. But it killed 47 people. We found 45 bodies, which means five bodies were effectively vaporized. I mean, this is the world we live in. This is what fracking looks like. All for me to be able to get on a dumb airplane today to fly down to Austin, Texas. But
of all places.
But to me, it's easy to look at these large incidents and say that's a big problem. But we're also now going to have to be looking at what does it mean in states where agriculture or ranching are the predominant industries, but water quality is compromised. What does it mean over the long term to have topsoil completely wiped out? Because fracking also needs to use salt water as well. So what does that mean to have salt water spill across cropland? It's worse than oil. I mean, they knew this in biblical times. You can go back to the Old Testament. I could conquer your tribe, Thorn, and do anything, but I couldn't slash your olive trees and salt the land. It renders it sterile for a long, long time. Those are just a few of the things I think about when I think about fracking.
Okay, our guest is Taylor Rorby, this is fascinating. The book, incidentally, for those of you who didn't catch it at the beginning, is Fracture: Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. What have we got? Do we have time? Do you have something that you can read for us that we can do in about 3 to 4 minutes?
Sure. I can do a little poem. How about
this? Do a little poem.
I'll do a little poem by one of our country's best poets, Alison Hawthorne Deming. Her poem's called Homeland Security. What is a day to the astronaut floating 200 miles above Earth, the space station whirling 15 times a day around the globe's circumference while he drifts weightless, as if unmoving, sipping meals from a plastic pouch? Is that how it works, keeping everything contained against the drift? His twin is down there donating biometrics to the database. What is a year to them, to their bones and hearts and brains? That's what the instruments want to know, or what we've taught them to want. Did I mention that the space twin, too, is donating his stats? He'll pay the higher price for his unearthly habitation. Bodies need gravity or some system that simulates the magnetic pull of mantle and core. He can see home from a small window in space, the planet from out there, sublime, a blue and white ball, so tender it might be made of glass just forming at the tip of the glassblower's rod. The Earth twin watched his brother lift off from the Cosmodrome, 0 to 17,000 in 12 minutes. It feels like the hand of God has come down and grabbed you by the collar and ripped you off the planet. You're either going to float in space or you're going to be dead. What is Earth to the astronaut? It is the exception to emptiness. Sure, other planets lie further out in the black concealment of space. Best perhaps that we do not know their voraciousness and need. Ours, we know, is troubled by privilege, greed, yet still in the heyday of its experiment with life. What is an atmosphere, and how did Earth get one? Thanks, cyanide bacteria, for your evolutionary gift, the great oxygenation event that made us possible. I'm writing this to find my way into the fray over fracking, wild card as it seems now that I've gone so far out into space. But no one wants to hear again about flaming water faucets, exploiting towns and farms, heartland riddled with quakes, water poisoned and stuck back in the ground to find its way home. Space might be the only way to see what kind of sky we need and how the great carbonation event might be flipping the way Earth does or doesn't do life. We say blue marble. We say Mother Earth. We say home. The astronaut says beautiful. Earth from space says keep me. Homeland Security means leave it in the ground, lock it up with soldiers standing guard, cover it with grassland and trees.
Wow. I love it. Taylor Brorby, I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio.
Tons of hurtling steel, screaming round the curve, nobody at the wheel. Everyone said don't pay it any mind, there's a pot of gold waiting at the end of the line. Just move with the eye of the hurricane, we'll never get off of this runaway train.
Symphonic in form, euphoric in heart, this volume brings together a great, sometimes desperate chorus that ought to be heard world over, wherever there is oil and gas-rich shale below and living things above. The book is Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America, and it's from Ice Cube Press. The author, who is sitting right across from me, or sort of diagonally across from me, is Taylor Borby, award-winning essayist and poet and environmentalist.
That's right.
Taylor, tell me how you conceived this book. Tell me how you put it together. Let's talk a little bit about some of the material in it.
Sure. So once Steve had said, let's run with this, I brought on the co-editor, Stephanie Brooktrout, who is a schoolmate of mine and had actually worked on a previous anthology and brings just a sharp editorial eye. We drafted a open call for submissions and sent it around to hundreds of creative writing and environmental writing programs around the country, looking for emerging environmental writers, seeing what we weren't getting through mainstream environmental writing and more established names, you know, Bill McKibben in particular. Our first sort of large name to agree when I had emailed her to contribute something was Patty Limerick, known formally as Patricia Nelson Limerick, who teaches at UC Boulder, who I get to hang out with next week. She's one of the foremost environmental historians in the country and has shifted the landscape of environmental history. And once you approach these other big environmental writers and say, Patty Limerick's going to be a part of this project, do you want to be? Most people say yes. And when you approach Bob Jetson, he'll say yes to it as well. So it was...
And that's a hard get.
It is a hard get. Well,
we're looking over at Bob Jetson, who's sitting in the corner. So,
but part of it was just, it was really humbling to know that people who you revere, who have shaped your own writing and thinking, were willing to be a part of a project. I mean, what a gift. And for me, I kept thinking, well, I can write my own book on fracking, but it's also easy to dismiss what Taylor Borby has to say. But how much fun to be a part of a choir. And that, I think, is really what Stephanie and I helped shape here as we were thinking about this. We kept growing the project, which publishers don't always like. At first we said, well, it'll be 200 pages. It'll be 300. And now it's it could be your doorstop, Thorne. It's about 480 pages.
Well, that's why I'm getting two of them.
That's right. Exactly. It's a good weightlifting routine.
And it's also if you're crawling home, maybe you had a few too many, and you're crawling home and it's the doorstop and you can sort of read a couple of
exactly. But it was a wonderful way to just sort of bring in people that we know are seminal voices on an issue like this, but to bring in people we haven't yet heard of in the literary writing community.
And that's amazing. That's what's fascinating about it, because you have such an interesting range of contributors.
We have people who are social workers, who are science teachers, who are creative writers, who are photographers, who are environmental activists, who are lawyers. What a rich, diverse group. It's a wonderful thing to be a part of.
You know, and in this day and time, I think, with the exception of a few in the denial community, the environment can bring a lot of us together.
And I think that's what we're seeing here. You know, there are 26 states represented in this book, and that, to me, also felt like such a little feather in the cap to just see that it wasn't just people from Texas or Oklahoma or New York or Pennsylvania submitting work, but places we don't really think of. And that's satisfying as well, to feel like you're building a type of community.
Tell me about some of the material in the book.
So we have all three of the, what we would call the primary creative writing genres represented. We have poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. And I'm sure some listeners will go, oh, fiction, where they just get to make everything up, right? But I find the fiction not only very believable, but in some regards, it's tame compared to what reality looks like and what we're going through. But we have an interesting braid in different themes that come up in work. We have themes of what it means to be a feminist, who's also an activist. We have themes of what it means to have clean drinking water, themes of what it means to be on the forefront of fighting pipelines around the country, what it means to be an American Indian and feeling like another type of conquest has come home to roost as well. We have people who are taking the long view to think about future generations, like Carolyn Raffensperger, who helped create the precautionary principle. We have people who are looking at the immediate present and what that means as well. And so I think for readers, there will be certain things that are repetitive throughout. Like, good readers will realize, well, the oil industry really likes using white cars. And a lot of stories and essays say, oh, yeah, there were a fleet of white cars here. But part of it, too, is structured so that wherever readers open and pick up the book, they might get a piece within the 4 to 5 piece range that gives them a little bit of history over fracking. And though fracking, the technology might look the same, how it's been implemented and the effects of it look different depending on the state and the region.
Right. Fracking really has sort of outlived us, even in the terms of the fossil fuel industry, has kind of like run its distance.
I think so. I mean, right now, oil costs less per barrel than a bucket of KFC chicken right now. And that's just mind-boggling to me. A year and a half ago, it was 75% higher. It was over $100 a barrel. And we didn't think the bust was coming, or some of us didn't want to acknowledge that the bust was coming. And now, though the technology might be going away or things are slowing, now is really the time where we've seen what we've wrought and what that means. And that's frightening in the context of climate change and what that might mean for the future and our ability to know aquifers were more substantially drained because of this process to get a very short-term product. I mean, oil is an incredible energy source. To think you can use a few drops of oil and you can plow your whole field very quickly compared to backbreaking work. It also means we've been living on borrowed time right now, and fracking has added to that to externalize costs on future generations, if not ourselves already.
It's created a lot of boom towns that are soon going to be ghost towns, perhaps, too.
And right now, I mean, for example, where I come from and, in North Dakota, the town of Williston, which was sort of boomtown central in the Bakken, now has a $210 million debt to pay off because they were living on the promise of tomorrow. And I think things are about to get very interesting in the political landscape about how we do or don't take care of these communities into the future.
Are you going to read something else for us?
I can read something.
I loved the poem you read earlier, so let's hit it.
All right. This is I guess I would call it an essay, though it might be slight fiction. It sort of blurs the genres. It's the opening piece to the collection. It's called Seduction. It's by this wonderful writer named Mary Heather Noble. And for those of you out there in Radioland, it's only about 313 words, so I hope you're impressed with what she can do. It's a bit like adolescence, all this newfound attention that you think you understand, and the young man sitting on your mother's flowered couch is polite and respectful in a way that she'd sworn had gone extinct, talking about your future and security and the wealth of opportunities to come. And though you barely even know him, you can't help but feel a little taken with his outsider accent, his pressed polo shirt with the company logo over his heart, the way he folds his long fingers around your mother's chipped coffee mug as the steam from the brew rises and dances around his lips, which keep moving and assuring you that it will be safe, and think of the potential of this place. He uses noble words like exploration and independence and speaks of recovery in a way that means returning to normal or a healthy state of being, as if the way you've been living here is neither of these things. He speaks of recovery as in returning something to its rightful owner, which is you and your family. Of course you want what's yours. You'll remember those moving lips when the trucks come rumbling in hour after hour, again and again, and the midnight light from the drill pad trespasses through your drawn bedroom curtains, the clanging and pounding invading the silences of your room. You'll remember those promises as you try to ignore the chemical veil and swallow the anxiety of what could be seeping into your well. Of course you want what's yours, but you won't know what they're taking when you unlock the gate and let them in, forcing and drilling, injecting God knows what into God knows where, and you'll think you're doing this for your future, think you're doing this out of love. But what do you know of love except for your mother's palm olive hands and the dance of the willows before a storm? A clean glass of water, the crescendo of cicada in the afternoon, the smell of wildflower dew. You'll be fooled by the softness of what they promise in the beginning, the finesse, but shocked by the unexpected violence of a frack. There's a persistent sting to innocence lost, a trace of diesel in the air.
Well, Taylor Rorby reading the work of
Mary Heather Noble.
Mary Heather Noble. Lovely. Why is it, you know, there's lots of different ways to fight against injustice, to fight against things like the environmental impact of what we're doing to the world right now, of various social issues. Why is it important to use literature, to use poetry? What is the special role that it can play in this effort?
I think it allows us to live in a story. You know, so much of our life is spent in flashes. We have Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat, and media is becoming shorter and shorter. Long-form journalism seems to be going away, much to my own sadness. Yeah. I think literature and fiction and poetry allows us to live in a type of story and forces us to have to pay attention. And it allows us to see someone else's lived reality, which I think newspapers try to do at their best. This is also something that sits with you, I think. A poetry is something you can commit to memory. I certainly had to do that in school. But it also unhinges your brain in a different way. It allows you to maybe see things a little clearer when they're juxtaposed to ideas, let's say, Alison Hawthorne Deming's. Who knew where that astronaut poem was going to go? And when fracking slips in there sideways, just like horizontal drilling, it sort of blows you out of the water. And I think that's what a good piece of literature can do. It can sit with you long after you've finished it. And it's something you can come back to again and again.
Right. Wow. Tell us about some of the other things that are in the book.
So there are some preachy pieces, for sure, if you're left of center. There are pieces that take a more holistic view of the history of fracking. Tyler Priest, who got his PhD right here in the great state of Texas at the University of Houston, does history on oil and natural gas and sort of gives us an overview of what that technology has looked like over the past. We have people like Kathleen Dean Moore, who's one of the country's noted moral philosophers, meditating on what North Dakota looks like from an airplane and writes about, you know, it takes oil to get her up in the air. But the thoughts of the future. We've got Rich Satire by Bill Rohrbach, who's one of the country's just great fiction writers, who also just gets you to laugh out loud when you're reading, because you do need a little humor every now and then when you're talking about things that can be so serious. We've got people who talk about sandboxes, like John Jensen, no relation to Bob here, but talking about the frack sand that's really coveted in what's called the Driftless area of Wisconsin and Iowa. We've got people that take stock of what's passing before our eyes, of species that very well might go extinct, like the sage grouse or the pallid sturgeon, because of this type of technology. We've got people who lament what the current state of the world looks like, and I think that's part of what this book does, is the wider culture doesn't want us to grieve and pay attention. And I think grieving is a very healthy thing. It allows us to process what's happening around us, what we're a part of. And I hope, too, it gives us strength after we've grieved to get back up and to do something about it. Because if we just bend over backwards, if this book just sits on its shelf and doesn't inspire someone to do something, that's a failure on my part as the editor.
Hopefully at least they'll recycle it.
That's right. Well, and it's made with some wonderful recycled papers, too.
I sure hope they don't do that. You talked earlier about long-form journalism, and there are poets who have done poetry that they consider to be journalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting how crossing forms, but I noticed you do not have any threads of tweets.
No, we don't have anything of tweets. We have sort of what I would call segmented essays, which may be, you know, they're a little longer than tweets, but paragraphs that connect, but nothing that short in here. You know, though you are welcome to tweet the anthology whenever you like. So we do have a Twitter handle.
I tweet little. I do not tweet a lot. It's a form that I have never gotten comfortable with. So being an old school journalist,
yes,
and I like and being an old school journalist who's a little too verbose. Anyway, so I mean I'm doing fine if I can just sort of tone down the. Okay, well I think we're going to take another break, and this is fascinating.
This is great.
My guest is Taylor Broerby. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.
Growing houses in the fields between the towns, and the starlight driving movies closing down. The road is gone to the way it was before, and the spaces won't be spaces anymore. Two more farms were broken by the drought. First the Wagners, now the Fullers pulling out. Developers paid better than the corn. But this was not the place where they were born. This houses in the fields, no prayers for steady rain this year. Houses in the fields, there's houses in the fields. The last few farms are growing out of here. At first he wouldn't sell, and then he would. Now there'll be children playing where the silo stood. The word came from the marrow of his bones. It was the last sure way to pay off all the loans. Streets will be named for kings and queens, and a ransom will be paid for every castle's dream. The model sign is crested with a lion, and the farmers, they will have enough to die on. There's houses in the fields, no prayers for steady rain this year. Houses in the fields, there's houses in the fields. The last few farms are growing out of here.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio. My guest is Taylor Brorby. Tracy Schultz, what were we listening to? What's the music we've been listening to?
That's a couple of recommendations by our guest here during the recording, Mr. Robert Jensen. That last one was John Gorka, Houses in the Fields. And then right before that was somebody we all know, Eliza Gilkinson with Runaway Train. Somebody that that Robert knows fairly well. He can speak to.
Right. Okay. It's been great. It's been wonderful. Taylor Brorby is an award-winning essayist and poet, and his new book that he's edited is Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking in America. There are a couple of things we might clarify, and we might also go into a little more about what fracking is, how it came about, you know, what its role has been, and maybe where it's going.
That sounds great.
So why don't we do that?
Sounds good. Well, fracking has actually been around for quite a while. I mean, really, since about the 1940s and whatnot. But this is more what we call vertical drilling.
Right.
It's what fracking originally started out as. Part of how fracking has spread so rapidly, so quickly, was in 2004-ish. Some engineer who now probably owns many islands in the Caribbean developed what's called a whipstock. And a whipstock changed the whole game of what oil development looked like. Instead of having to drill down, like sticking a pin into a pin cushion, you could now bend pipe over several thousand feet to approach this rather thin level of oil horizontally, which means you wouldn't have to find such a large pocket of oil to keep pulling from. You just have shifted the game to approach a whole level of earth. And much of this is shale development, natural gas in Pennsylvania, oil in places like Texas and Oklahoma and North Dakota. But it allows you to approach the whole horizontal level of that bed of rock, and by which you get to shove a whole cocktail of chemicals down there for fracking.
Which breaks it loose.
Which breaks through the rock and breaks through the shale. And what happens is it needs about 2.2 million gallons to initially frack a fracking site. You have to continually be using new fresh water to do that as you're going down, because as it comes up, there's so much salt accumulation. It's sort of like arteries as you get older. Plaque builds up. So you need to blast through that salt accumulation. And once that's done, you start pulling oil out. I mean, there are tiny fractures that go out due into the shale bed that allow us to access and pull this oil. The difficulty of this type of fracking is it means you have to continually be exploring new well sites. Compared to Saudi Arabia, which is sort of like a sponge of oil, this level of earth doesn't
have
as much.
Well, I think there are places there where you can actually walk down the beach.
Right?
Exactly. You're splashing.
Exactly. And yeah. Not the case here in Texas
right.
at all.
Right.
And so part of this is you need to continually be to increase the amount of wells that you're exploring, because the longevity of these wells are very short. So that means, you know, places where we're experiencing booms can boom very quickly because you're continually having a money turnover to allow us to continue to invest in that technology. But once those wells start drying up and the price of oil starts going down rapidly, like what it's done over the past year and a half, it puts us in quite a pickle. What we're facing right now after that type of technology, which costs a lot of money, frankly. We're going well over a mile, in some cases almost 2 miles down into the earth to access this oil on land. It's not a cheap process.
And it's very low quality, and it's very dirty oil.
It's also very volatile oil as well, depending on your region. It's not as energy rich as Saudi oil. And also the hard thing is at least in this country, when we have the myth of energy independence, we now can see, well, Saudi Arabia can flood the market and Right now, you can have gas that's under $2 a gallon at the local gas station. It doesn't really mean we're energy independent from anyone.
No, no. $1.60 $1.65
Yeah,
right now.
It's impressive.
Here, so. But is it, do you think we're past the, are we on the slope back down? Is fracking not going to have much more of a life? What do you, and
I think that's still anyone's call right now on some level. I mean, partly just because of what we're seeing in the news, by which I mean Florida is now exploring the ability to frack because their oil is a little bit more accessible. David Cameron, at least in the UK, is purporting that he would like to frack the entire nation if he's given access to it. I think a lot of this is driven by, you know, lobbyists in the oil industry. It's allowing us to believe in the myth that oil will climb back up. Fracking is well positioned to help us get back on the track to energy independence. But that is yet to be seen. I mean, if the price of oil continues to go down, the ideal circumstances would be for alternatives to slip in there very quickly and become price point competitive to say this is, now is the time to really create an infrastructure that would help us get fully off of oil. The hard thing with the plummeting price of oil is that it actually should be skyrocketing if it's going to drive market economics right to do what it should do. Right now, things will bust, but if the price of oil slowly picks up again, it positions itself for this to have another boom of some kind. If that price continues to go up, we might move beyond it. But we might see a window of time where fracking has sort of, you know, a Lazarus effect. We might move beyond that very quickly, of course. But what we really need to hope for those of us who care about the habitability of the planet, is that oil become $1,200 a barrel, that you and I cannot afford to do this.
And then we have to look for alternative sources of energy.
I mean, we already have.
Or we have already looked. We don't have to look for them. We know what they are.
I think the hard thing is it's sort of like if you're addicted to Oreo cookies right now and there are like 5 Oreo cookies left, but someone tells you you can never have Oreo cookies again. Yeah. And we're not very good at saying no to Oreo cookies when they're in front of us.
So. No, and there's also transitions in terms of models.
And I mean, I think as we see, you know, the polar ice caps continue to melt too, we know there's a huge amount of previously inaccessible oil at our fingertips. I think part of, you know, what we have to explore with the future of fracking and what I hope some of the ideas brought up by this collection are, what does it mean to be moral and ethical thinking creatures and knowingly compromising life of every living thing on the planet? I mean, we needed to be off oil long ago, but now we're sort of like a kid who's gone on a sugar spree, you know, and we're just high on the horse.
But as we're learning so much about the damage it's causing to the environment and how serious that is, mm-hmm. Of course, we're very, very good in the society of just sort of shuffling that to the side. But how much is that affecting fracking as a...
I think right now our denial is at least sort of now coming back to the center. I mean, as we were talking about earlier with the slowdown of many of these booms, with towns now dissipating and being faced with new realities, I think people are rather roiled. You know, I mean, the water is now churning about the supposed promises of big market economics, the future of oil, of what towns were promised was going to happen. And of course, we haven't learned from the long cycle of what Wallace Stegner so expertly wrote about in the last century about the boom and bust cycle. I mean, this is the history, particularly of those of us who live west of the 100th meridian. It's a large area that agriculture can't be done unless it's irrigated water. Ranching is popular in these areas. But these are, you know, in terms of natural resources, pretty unrich areas. You know, there's not timber structures. There's not large vegetation. streams go dry in the summertime. Booming and busting is nothing new, but it's something we forget when faced with a large paycheck.
When you talk about denial moving towards the center, we're talking more specifically, but do you think that the whole climate denial phenomenon, which of course is part and parcel of a whole anti-science, anti-fact sort of virus that's taken hold in the society or in elements of the society, do you see that as having peaked and maybe is moving back?
I mean, I just sort of live in like...
This is an off-the-wall question.
Right? No,
I mean,
I mean, I live in the world of reality, and reality is showing us... I mean, if I show a climate model graph to my... to my nephews, you know, of the polar ice caps and go, well, look at what's happening to the ice. I mean, a 10-year-old can tell us what's going on, but somehow we like to be convinced that... denying factual information is a good thing. It's as if you were going to smoke a cigarette and just willfully deny there's any risk of cancer coming. And the popular figure people like to throw around is 97% of the scientific community agrees that climate change is happening, it's real, it's man-made. When you look at the papers, though, that are written on this topic, it's 99.5% of them agree. It's not even 97%. I mean, the reality is it's happening. People who want to live in blind ignorance of it, I think we are coming to a time where we have to realize they're like fossils.
And that other 0.5% is all in the employ of ExxonMobil.
That and Continental Resources.
And
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's... it's now, you know, I mean, the attack on higher education is also part of this issue, the neoliberal agenda as well, of thinking that anything that's Googleable, if that's, you know, a word, or able to be looked up online means it's gospel, which is not the case at all. Yeah. We still
Google is has definitely become a verb and
I think you know part of it too is we have given a platform known as the internet to people to spew whatever they like rather than creating a culture of intellectuals who go around to actually speak truth to this type of power to actually set the record straight. I mean, our universities used to be models of this, but they no longer reward people who do things like this. In fact, they get rid of their tenure and fire them. So I think part of this is also dovetailing with how we educate people or not educate people as well.
I think a whole lot of our problems in the society right now dovetail into...
And I think that gets back to the original question about people and their thinking on fracking. We know it's bad, yet we do it. And I just don't know why we don't move beyond that. I can give facts and figures as the day is long about what this looks like. At the end of the day, we just know it's a bad thing. It's good for corporate pocketbooks. It's good if you're coming out of the last economic recession and you need to put food on your table. It's not me wanting to go around and say, don't take a job. But part of the critique is that these large corporations have allowed us to be distracted and to live in a country where just putting food on the table should be good enough rather than the type of job we are doing and what it might be doing to the future.
Something that I neglected to make sure that our audience understood was earlier you were referring to the Bakken area, which is in North
It is, yeah.
North
it's
Dakota,
sort of my North it's Dakota. My research area, Thorne, but I mean in Texas.
But there are probably people out there who don't know what that is.
Right, and I mean in Texas, you know, you have the Eagle Ford development here, so it's not just fracking where I do my research.
Right.
It's right here in the state of Texas. Actually, UT Austin, if I'm not mistaken, has some land that is in its possession that has been explored with this technology as well.
Right.
So it's right here in the local listeners.
Something that's being, I think, acknowledged here now is the extent to which earthquakes are resulting from, I mean, increasingly, and obviously they're generally small earthquakes, but all of that stuff has an ongoing effect.
And that's sort of largely one of the questions I'm curious about, too, is not even what it means right now when we're feeling them, but what does that mean over the long term, geologically speaking, to know that We have altered the physical makeup of the ground under which we stand. And over the long term, how are we to know what that does to things like the water tables, to aquifers, and things like this?
Right.
So we can feel the quakes right now, which are certainly scary enough. I think there is a long view we need to be taking with these questions and these implications as well.
Okay, why don't you read something else for us?
Sounds great. Well, I'll read, I don't think we get enough poetry unless you listen to Garrison Keillor's The Writer's Almanac, but this is by one of the country's great poets who just won the Thoreau Award, Linda Hogan, who's from Oklahoma, and she's Chickasaw.
Right.
And her poem is called Greed. In spring, how desperate the first sprouts reach for water, mineral, the first tendrils and roots, greediest of all. The starving stand in shadows awaiting the end of any banquet. My infant takes his first breath, then hungers for more milk, more air, and then the pain of taking away is never gone. Without end, there is the want of something that can never be. The pain of such desire is more desire. Some take from all the others. They are still earth creatures, the hungry child, taken from the table, the breast, even earth's great and fertile fields, flowering and then letting go of the seed. All have forgotten what hides in the shadows where they once did. But then the greediest of all envy the immortals who return the envy as they long for a body. All earth senses they desire, the taste of sweet milk, fresh fruit. But gravity has its own desire to call us into the ground. How I wish words could return to the mouth like music to the flute or breath, as it was in the beginning, remembering the nourishment that began this precious world, but always remembering that even when the tide went out, the waves still came toward us, carrying some generous yield. Something yet holds purchase, holds sway in a world filled with green trust. Even the blade of grass recalls how to grow back its original blade. But I don't know what tide is arriving from the greed of American soil. Just like for mineral, now the search between rock, flint, shale.
Mm. Okay, Taylor Rorby, the poet. Again, what was her name?
Linda Hogan.
Oh, Linda Hogan. That's right. And I had been familiar with her before. The book is Fracture, Essays, Poems, and Stories on Fracking. And I think it's also interesting that you have a chapbook called Ruin, Elegies from the Bakken. Fascinating. Let me ask you a question. We've got just a couple of minutes left. What do you think about the alternative energy industry, where it stands now, and how much people are realizing that actually we can make that transition without losing a whole bunch of jobs and whatever.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Thorne. I think it's something that we also need to be aware of when one critiques, you know, big oil. Those of us who have family members or friends who are employed by this, we're, of course, not saying we just want to get rid of your jobs and there's nothing left for you. I mean, this means a great transition has to take place. But I think right now what we're seeing, too, I think it's just, I mean, to be esoteric, it's incredibly sexy what's happening in alternative energy right now. The Tesla battery blew my mind last year to think that you could get not only completely off the grid and be feeding money back into it, but that you wouldn't be reliant upon anything other than sunshine. Now, of course, we know the technology needs to develop so we can store that long term in some form rather than saying, well, in areas that aren't as sunny or aren't as windy, how does that work? You know, that to me is just one of these engineering problems. But I have to say, in my stubborn, you know, Westerner perspective, we put someone on the moon. This is a very small, you know, I mean, small right. potatoes, I think, right. really. If funding were ramped up in the way of, you know, how subsidies are distributed right now for big oil and things like this, this technology would have already been here. I think the other part of this, though, with alternative energy is also maybe us realizing that our comfortable and convenient lives have been a lie. I think part of it is us also acknowledging the way we have been living is not only, I don't really like to talk in sustainable or unsustainable terms, but it's been harming the planet. And to seek a more right way of living, that doesn't mean this romantic idea of let's, you know, do X, Y, and Z. But I think the future looks like buildings like the Bullitt Center out at Seattle University, which is the world's first living building. It makes LEED certified buildings, which are a rigorous process to be, you know, showing how much solar energy a building uses and things like this. It makes it look like a toddler. You know, they have compostable toilets, they have solar panels, they purify rainwater on site. I think our future will look a lot more like that, buildings designed well in place.
Taylor Rorby, thank you for being with us on Rag Radio.
A great pleasure, Thorne. Thank you.
This has been terrific.
Thank you.
Really have enjoyed it. Coming up, we've got Glenn Smith. We're going to talk some politics, and there's a lot of politics to talk. Jeez. And Jim Hightower will be with us in a couple of weeks. So lots of cool stuff happening. Thank you so much for being with us. And I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Rag Radio.